From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1964, when the Rochester International Film Festival truly went international. The festival was 5 years old at that point, and that year entries came in from across the United States and from 5 foreign countries as well. The next year, the festival became a charter member of the International Association of Amateur Film Festivals, which is a worldwide organization dedicated to establishing standards among film festivals. And it has continued ever since. Tonight, the 2016 Rochester International Film Festival opens at the Dryden Theater, running through Saturday, 27 films, free public viewing. And this hour, we're going to meet some of the filmmakers who've come from around the world. We'll talk about the process of creation and storytelling, why they chose to tell the stories they are telling in this year's festival. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests, starting with Josephine Perini. She is with Movies on a Shoestring, which is the history of the film festival. It starts there. We'll talk about that. Welcome, Josephine. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And going around the table, Joe Bellavia is a Rochester-based director of a film called Long John. 17 minutes, and anybody who lives in Rochester will relate in really raw, painful ways. It's nice to see you here. Thanks for being here, Joseph.
Thanks for having me.
Pete Ireland is here, and his film is called Chip, and I can't wait to talk about why he wanted to tell the story. It's the story of, if you know Woodstock, it's the man you saw on stage doing a lot of the introductions and on the microphone, and a fascinating story all told in 3 minutes. Pete's here from Sydney, Australia, is that right?
Sydney, Australia, that's the one. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome. Thanks for being here. And Ian Massery's here, cinematographer and a storyline producer and editor of a film called 59 Days of Independence. And Ian, it's great to have you as well. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, Josephine, 27 films this year, yes?
Yes.
And you've got films from, obviously, right here, sort of a cross-section in this very room. What's the goal of the festival, though? I mean, how much do you look to do international films, domestic films, et cetera?
Well, we start out accepting all films, narrative, documentaries, animations, under 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. So we had about 150, and our membership looks at these, reviews them, and decides should they be kept for final judging. If they're kept for final judging, then they go on to another screening. But we are, I think, the only film festival in the world that sends a critique letter about what we have seen, and the filmmakers really appreciate that. So,
whether they get in or not. Is that right?
Yes, okay. Everybody does. Yeah. And we do not make a distinction as categories. We do not make a distinction as one film is going to get the award. We give our very, very famous Shoestring Trophy to everyone who is screened, and this year it will be 27 filmmakers.
Okay, it starts tonight at the Dryden. All the films are at the Dryden, yes. And what time tonight, Josephine?
8 o'clock Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and a 4 o'clock on Saturday.
And you'll see how many films, if you go at 8 o'clock tonight, you're going to see how many?
Well, they're on our website, rochesterfilmfest.org. There's about 7 each night, and then one night there must be 8.
Okay.
I mean, one night, six.
Yes, that's right. And the website is rochesterfilmfest.org here. And so of the 150 plus that were submitted, 27 films. And let me start with Pete Ireland, who is a filmmaker. You're from Sydney, Australia. You're still based there, yeah?
Yeah, still based there, yeah.
Okay. And you created a film called Chip, and I want you to, first of all, just let our listeners know who Chip is.
So Chip is Edward Beresford Chip Monk, and he was the MC, stage manager and production manager, and sort of accidental MC of the Woodstock Music Festival.
Woodstock, and so you go back to 1969, 450,000 people were there at the Dairy Farm in upstate New York. Now it's something like 45 million people say they were there. It sort of feels like everyone was there. But for a lot of people who have seen the documentary that came out next year or various clips, you probably know Chip. What about his story did you gravitate to?
He's one of those people who's lived a thoroughly interesting life. You know, he ran off to join the circus when he was a kid. True story. He worked at the Fillmore East and a few of those kind of really iconic places, the Village Gate in New York. Bob Dylan typed Hard Rain's Gonna Fall on his typewriter in his basement. He's got one of those kind of crazy lives. And then at a certain point, things started kind of slowing down. You know, he started sort of going from a rock god to a kind of a normal person. And I just found that sort of side of things really interesting, that, you know, you can be up there with the bright lights and you can be with those kind of iconic names. But when I visit him now, he's drinking broccoli seeds because he's, you know, he's trying to, you know, keep his health up, and he's just living a kind of a hermity sort of a life in Melbourne, Australia. So,
but he looks, from what I've seen in the interviews, rather buttoned up. You know, it doesn't look like a 1969, you know, sort of afraid frilly tie dye, you know, watch out for the brown acid, free love everywhere kind of a look. He's changed.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is you got to remember he was a guy who was putting together the stages. That was his main role. So imagine a really, I don't know if I can say this, anally retentive.
Of course you can say.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
You're not allowed to say that in Australia.
No, we are, but I guess I was kind of being careful.
The translation.
Yeah, exactly.
Anal retentive.
Guy, he's, you know, a little bit OCD, you know, doing like, you know, the biggest Lego sets you've ever seen, you know, for Jimi Hendrix and all the rest of it. So I think a person like that tends to obviously not be maybe as kind of rock and roll, even though he's lived the rock and roll lifestyle. Yeah.
The film, I think it opened, and now I've seen a bunch, so I think it opens, his own voice telling the crowd about the brown acid, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's actually the original audio. So he got up and gave this famous warning about the brown acid not being too good. So, yeah. which depending on which story, I mean, he's a bit of a storyteller now in his older age, and he'll it depends on who you believe. There's one set of the story that says it's because people were tripping out on brown acid and it wasn't a good trip, and so he needed to warn them. The other side story, which I've heard, and he could just be riffing, is that his friend was selling the blue acid, and so he needed to kind of help his friend with sales. He's kind of riffed that to me, but I don't know, maybe he was just, you know, trying to make me laugh.
At this point, 40-some-odd years later, who knows what's apocryphal and what's real.
Exactly.
But that is his voice. That's the original audio.
That is him, yep.
At that famous moment. And I think he concludes by saying, but it's your trip, right?
Your trip, so be my guest. And there's lots of those kind of moments, I think, scattered throughout Woodstock, is that he got up. That's why his voice kind of became iconic, is he got up and sort of said, okay, everyone, we're all going to get up. We're going to move everybody back. And he moved 450-something thousand people back three steps because they were getting too close to the fences, because the story of Woodstock is it was all very chaotic. They were supposed to be at a totally different farm, and then when the farmer saw how many people were showing up, freaked out and said, no, you can't have it here. So then they had to move the whole thing down the street, and it was supposed to be a paid event, but they didn't have a time to set up the cash booths, so it ended up being a free concert. Like, it's all a very kind of a crazy sort of a story. Yeah.
The interesting thing for me is, you know, I think in college when the Woodstock 99 was happening, and that was sort of a disaster. It was in Rome, New York, and, you know, they tried to emulate a lot of what had happened 30 years prior, but there were reports of violence, reports of rapes, and it kind of got shut down early. It was sort of a mess. You go look back in 1969. You got one guy, you said, moving 450,000 people, but people were doing it.
Yeah,
and for all of the people, you know, the rumor that the governor wanted to call in 10,000 National Guard and all of these questions on safety. I wonder how much Chip gets credit for at least being a calming voice at that moment.
Look, he does. And what's funny is I think, you know, there was a couple of announcements and I think a couple of things that happened, particularly around crowd safety, that because he kind of took a very, very laid back and he's got that big booming kind of Massachusetts voice, that I think everybody kind of went, oh, it's okay. It's kind of like we've got this sort of guiding hand that's sort of taking care of us. But he was also at Altamont when Altamont went crazy with the Rolling Stones. Yeah. And
that was in, I think, December of that year, later that same year.
He was basically then went on to be the stage manager and production manager for the Rolling Stones. And so he's sort of been this person who's had to guide these really crazy moments where rock stars are being, I guess it's at a time when rock stars were really being rock stars. You know, like he's got this story about Keith Richards, for whatever reason, in this hotel, which was kind of like shaped like a toilet cylinder, you know, like the cardboard cylinder inside the toilet roll. And so the foyer was in the middle. And for no apparent reason, he just threw a table out of his window and it just landed in the foyer. And Chip had to manage the consequences because Keith just, and he said, why did you do that? And Keith was just like, I just wanted to see what would happen. You know, that's basically like proper rock stars. So he's managing all this kind of stuff, essentially. Yeah.
How did you first hear his story?
Well, he's, strangely enough, because, again, he's living this kind of hermity life in Melbourne, he's ended up being a family friend. Like, he's sort of through a connection. For the other filmmakers, I'm sure that's how a lot of stories end up coming your way, is that, you know, somebody just says, hey, I know this person. And I was like, oh, no, that can't be the Woodstock MC. You know, he's living in this little suburb in Melbourne. It can't be. And then I go and visit him, and he's got this enormous mustache, and he's got all of this memorabilia of all these photos that he's taken, and just crazy, crazy stuff, like the original tickets from Woodstock. And we just sat down and started talking and eating food, and he started telling me about, you know, how Truman Capote used to come and, you know, sleep on his couch, and you know, just crazy stuff. Like, you know, like I said, the Bob Dylan thing as well. And, you know, he married a Ford model. And, you know, and actually when I got there, the first time I met him, he's like, you know, sorry, the place is a bit of a mess. Bob Geldof was here yesterday. And I'm like, what life are you living? You know what I mean? So and then we just had a whole bunch of sessions where we just ate food and smoked cigarettes. And basically just chatted about his life. And, yeah, it was just really riveting stuff. You know, it's kind of crazy pop culture, you know, being the center of it type stuff.
There is a moment in that short film that Pete put together where Truman Capote pops in. And I guess he has the drink that he wants or a couple, and he lays down in his full suit and sleeps on the couch.
Yeah, and this blue blankie thing, blanket. which we made reference to, but Chip talks about a lot, is that he actually was totally, the blue blankie was this thing that Truman always had to have, his blue blankie. It sounded kind of crazy to me, but Chip does this great impression of him and made it sound totally reasonable that Truman would want his blue blankie. Because the impression of Truman Capote, you know, in the actual film is Chip doing Truman.
That's Chip. Yeah. I actually wondered that.
Yeah, he does such a great impression of him. And he said, yeah, he just used to show up and just, you know, say, give me food, give me wine. They would chat, and then he would ask for his blue blankie. And you had to go and there were times when it was dirty because he'd stayed the night before, and he would get crazy about it. So they had to wash it and dry it quickly so that he could then sleep on the couch. This is totally mental.
So, Pete, this is a guy, Chip seems to be a guy who has been at a lot of iconic places or been with a lot of hugely famous names and people, but he's never at the center of it. He's sort of an observer or a friend of it or the guy who has to clean up the mess of it. He's had this interesting historical perspective, and, you know, it comes through even in 3 minutes, but that is an interesting story to tell because we're all telling the stories about the people that he worked with, et cetera. And now he gets a little light, I guess.
Yeah, right? It's. I guess the thing is, he's been recognized for his achievements. Like he's won the Parnelli Award, which I'll be honest, I had to look it up. It's it's a lighting design award, and you know he's been recognized. He gets people sending him. Like, you know, people who've staged the Olympics in terms of lighting design sending him their signed book that says "To Chip, the Godfather of Stage Lighting" or something like that. So he's very in that sort of inner circle. He's recognized for what he does. But, I mean, you're right. He's kind of been next.
Right now, all of the lighting design listeners who are like, how did you not know this? Come on. But apart from the lighting design crowd.
Totally. Yeah. There's an international alliance of lighting designers as well that I didn't know about that he put me onto as well. But yeah, look, and I think the cool thing about him is, you know, he is aware of his place kind of being next to the rock stars. But, you know, he also has a certain amount of pride as well in the sense that he was a part of all of these things. So yeah, it is an interesting kind of a mix of ego and also humility, which makes him sometimes a difficult interview. He is a bit pernickety. It took a day to get 3 minutes of dialogue of him sort of narrating his own story because he's very clear about, well, hang on, I wouldn't have said it that way, and I wouldn't, you know, and which is totally fine. That's normal for a documentary, but he's particularly, because, you know, he's probably starting to think about legacy and all that sort of things.
All right, well, then let me just ask a few process questions then. Why a 3-minute film instead of a 5 or a 10 or something else?
Totally. Look, it was for TEDx, so the TED Talks, yep, side of things. They had a very, very particular length of time that they wanted. So we actually went over the time, but we were kind of like, how do we cover 50 years in 2 minutes? Yep. So we negotiated with them and they said, yeah, that's fine. So we were commissioned for a broadcast or for a screening outcome, which was to play at TEDx Sydney at the Opera House in front of 2,300 people at the Opera House. So, yeah.
And then he is giving you so much material. I mean, if he was only the guy from Woodstock and didn't do anything else, you could still be strained to get within 3 minutes, let alone the Capote, Dylan, all the other everything else, right? So what was your approach to figuring out how can we tell this in 3 minutes?
Yeah, it started off with the visuals. It actually started off with us looking at saying, okay, how do we tell a 50-year story with visuals that can get us through? So obviously it's one of those things you need to see, but we use there's a section where he's falling through the sky and balloons are passing him, and they have kind of milestones written on them. So the idea is kind of the passage of time done in an interesting way. So we had to kind of plan how it would look, how it would work as a visual story, and then chat to him about what he was willing to say in terms of narration of his own story. And the other big part of it was we didn't want it to be a talking head, because I can't think of anything worse than a person who's had a really interesting life sitting there for 5 minutes saying, I'm the best because I did all this great stuff and Bob Dylan. So what we wanted to do is we used animation as a way of bringing his memories to life to make it feel like it was contemporary. It was happening in real life, basically.
Well, that's... first of all, I thought it was really effectively done. And second of all, it was neat to see him at the end.
Yeah.
You finally get to see him. But how has it come off, in your own view? First of all, you happy with the product?
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
How has it come off since you put it out into the world?
Yeah, no, it's gone really well. It's screened in, there's a specialist documentary festival in Australia. It's our only documentary festival. It's called Antenna. It's played there. It's played in some other, we've got an Australian Academy, there's BAFTA and there's the American Academy. We've got the ACTA. That's our Australian Academy of Cinematic and Television Arts, I think it's called. So that it's screened in some actor accredited festivals in Australia. It's obviously, and then it's the other thing was, it won actually at the Actor Awards. So our Academy Awards in Australia, it won one of the short film prizes there. So
very good, Josephine. You want to just share your thoughts on it? I mean, it was I thought it was brilliant,
exceptional, and exactly what I said was, how do you do this all in 3 minutes? I wanted more, but it was perfect the way it was done. Yeah.
Megan Mack, producer, maybe you can help me find, what was the category that Louis C.K. was presenting at the Oscars where he said, these are the ones who are going home in a Honda Civic or something like that.
It was the short documentary.
I mean, I wondered if the people in this room had seen that and appreciated that remark.
He was 100% correct. Hilarious, because basically I think he said that normally the Oscar trophy goes home to a mansion. He said this one's going home in a Honda Civic. and he's right. It's funny, actually. I indirectly know. So the lady that won for her short documentary, she, I think, edited a feature documentary with a guy that I know. And he said, yeah, crazily talented, obviously, person, but one of those people who just has to be prolific to stay, I don't know, employed, I guess.
Sure, exactly. And the reason I thought of Louis C.K.'s remarks, and if I were smart, I would have thought of it before the program and actually pulled the audio, but, I'm not that smart a guy. But the reason I thought about that was you're describing all of the work, research, planning, animation, et cetera, for a 3-minute film, and it's not going to be a $20 million, $200 million, et cetera. And I'm looking at this saying, you have to love what you do, and I really admire that.
I have taught a little bit in terms of film students and all the rest of it, and it's ultimately the first thing that you spot with new filmmakers is, are they doing it for the right reasons? Are they doing it because they actually want to tell stories? And you actually have to, I think in this day and age, you actually have to say to them, you have to be prepared for the fact that you might be telling stories and only make enough to get by, have a living and live a life telling stories. And that has to be enough, because if you actually look at the number of films made every year, I think it's, the last time they looked at it was 800 to 1200 feature films. It's probably more than that now. But the ones that are worth the 50 to 100 million and all the rest of it is such a small proportion of those 800 to 1200 films. And then you think about how many find an audience and find success, that you just have to embrace it for the passion of telling stories, and living a life telling stories has to be what you're into. And then maybe if you're a gambler, you think, well, if one out of 50 films, is a success, it only takes one, which is what the gamblers always say. It's the next role. That'll be the one. but I guess it's that thing of, telling stories has to be what drives you. Yeah.
Well, we're talking about the Rochester International Film Festival. Opens tonight. When can we see Chip, by the way?
Just Saturday night.
A Saturday night at the Dryden. So tonight and tomorrow night, and then Saturday at 4 and 8, is that
yes.
right? So tonight at 8, tomorrow night at 8, Saturday 4 and 8 at the Dryden. It's free. Donations are accepted.
Yes.
27 different films in this, the 58th annual Rochester International Film Festival. And we've been talking to some of the filmmakers. You've been hearing from Pete Ireland, whose film is Chip. And we're kind of continuing around the table and talking about the inspirations for how these films were made. And Joseph Bellavia is a Rochester-based director of a film that is way longer than Chip. This is 17 minutes long. I think about 17, 16 minutes?
17,
17
yeah.
Minutes, yeah. And the film is called Long John. And it opens in a very familiar place. You are inside a very cold, snow-covered car in Rochester. And someone is starting the car early and starting to dig out. And especially in the last couple of winters. Now, this was the sort of the winter that wasn't, but the previous two were really, really raw. And I laughed out loud at several points of this film, Joe, but I want you to first tell me why you decided to tell this particular story.
Well, the story is about John, during a frigid winter, discovers the warmth and beauty of long underwear and how it can be disastrous for his love life. And it was two winters ago that was just brutal for me, and I would be walking into work from a parking lot way away from the building I worked in and cursing under my breath.
So that was you, right?
Essentially,
there's
yes.
There's a lot of you in that character.
So I broke down and bought long underwear, and it like made me feel so good. Like I was like, I was strolling into work then. And
but
I was
no
like,
one knew you were wearing
no,
it, right?
No, not at all. But then I had a friend having drinks, and he came in, and he was complaining about the cold and freezing. I'm like, have you ever tried long underwear? And he's like, dude, no way. Don't even, I can't believe you're admitting that to anybody. And I was like, really? Is it that big of a, I mean, I was a little embarrassed to tell him anyways, but he made me really self-conscious about it. I was like, is it really that big of a taboo? So then I was like, oh, what if I got in a romantic situation with a lady and I had these on? And then my imagination took away.
Could that be a mood killer? Yes. So the film has a character much like Joe, who's describing his own experience and has to encounter that decision of how am I going to get around this? My favorite moment of the whole film was when he was going out on this date and considering going out without the long underwear just for that very consideration. And it is so, he's almost a totally different person when the long underwear is on, his mood, the way he treats people, the way he responds to the cold, he can't do it. I mean, it has changed him. I really enjoyed that. But then he had to figure out, well, what am I going to do about it? And I don't want to ruin it, but there was a laugh out loud moment for me. The near death scene.
Yeah. But I give a lot of credit to my actor, Brayson Harold. He did an incredible job of that, you know, dual personality of when people in Rochester understand when it's so bitter, you become bitter.
You know, so bitter cold,
bitter
you
cold
become a bitter
equals
person.
Bitter person.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think everybody's waiting for this to thaw and become better people again, you know, but.
All right. And not to go too full house on the audience, but I'm going to ask you, I mean, you really did give us sort of a warm-hearted message at the end, you know, sort of a message of acceptance. And I enjoyed that. You know, it sort of made me feel good inside. And, you know, how did you, did you not want to be too overt with it, or did you feel like, you know what, this is an important message, we're gonna sell it here?
I think it works well for. I mean, no, I think this person is in search for something that makes them feel good, and he should be able to accept certain things about himself too. So yeah, I want a little bit of a moral to come through.
Sure.
Of accepting yourself, no matter your flaws. No matter if you wear long underwear.
You made this film, you released this out into the world. It was finished when?
I did it part of my graduate studies at RIT. So I screened in May, kind of finished things up a little bit in June, July, and then I started submitting into festivals.
And how has it gone?
Very well. I think this will be my 10th festival.
Wow.
I've won a few awards in other festivals and in only cold places.
So where people totally can relate to it. Yeah.
Frozen Festival in St. Paul, Minnesota. Snowtown Festival in Watertown. Buffalo. Buffalo International Film Festival. And And off-season shorts.
Yeah, in,
what'd you say?
The Antarctica International Film Festival.
I have not submitted to Antarctica. Well, then I was thinking maybe I should submit to Alaska, and I was like, well, they're probably it's totally accepted. Long underwear is totally accepted. So it's rare to find the places that it's a little taboo. You know,
I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah,
it probably would flop in Tampa, though. You know.
Yeah. Well, you got a lot of like people flying down there because of their cold weather.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it brings them back home.
So, what is your goal as a filmmaker? You know, not only with a film like this, but also going forward. I mean, you know, sometimes success begets success, but we also know that as much as we, you know, as Pete said, you can hope for that one breakthrough, that lottery ticket, that viral success, whatever it is. But you could create a very successful short film or a documentary film or an animated film. That doesn't really guarantee anything for the next film or the next five. So what is the goal for you?
Well, I kind of, as Pete said, like, I love telling stories. Mm-hmm. And I actually love the awkwardness and awkward moments of life and, like, to kind of show those. Because in a lot of Hollywood, everything is perfect or absolutely atrocious, and there's those moments that just, you know, are awkward, and I like to share those, like, in my own stories. But I would love to share fantasy stories and thrillers and stuff like that too, but I think it's a little bit more realistic at this point in time to share those stories that are a little more real.
Okay, and agree with Pete, you know, sort of a labor of love, it better be, right?
Well, yeah, like, filmmakers are kind of crazy to do what we do. It's like, and especially when you're working with no budgets, you're begging everybody for help. You know, like, I need extras for a scene, and I'm sending out Facebook posts and, you know, offering free food, you know, and that's all you can offer when you don't have those big budgets. But it is a labor of love, and then you have that end product that you can, you know, that people enjoy. And that's the reward, is when it does connect with people.
The film's called Long John. Can see it when, Josephine?
Friday night.
Somebody should know here.
Friday night.
Tomorrow night at the Dryden. If you're just joining us, talking about the Rochester International Film Festival, which kicks off tonight at the Dryden at 8 p.m., free films. And Josephine Perini is here from Movies on a Shoestring, which created the festival, really, going back to 1959. So let's go ahead and take a short break, and we'll come back and find out about the third film that we're going to talk about in this hour. Ian Massery's here, and we're going to talk about 59 Days of Independence. And I want to talk about 1959 and how this festival has grown from those early days and what it was intended to be. So more with the filmmakers next. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren joins me live in studio for the hour. She's fresh off her State of the City address, so we'll be talking about her plans for economic development and job creation. Big announcement last night about education and struggling Rochester schools, and more. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You've been hearing from some filmmakers from around the world, from right here, from RIT, and Ian Massery is the cinematographer, storyline producer, and editor of 59 Days of Independence. You might as well tell us where you come from, Ian. Go ahead.
Well, I come from the Gambia, West Africa.
Very good.
And 59 Days of Independence is a film that I worked on with some fellow colleagues of mine that weren't able to make it. And I think it's a terrible shame, but you know, hopefully I'm able to represent the team in a good way.
Well, this film splits the difference between the two films we've talked about already. It's a little in the middle. I think it's about 7 minutes, 7-8 minutes?
7 minutes. Yeah.
7 minutes. And why don't you tell the audience what story you wanted to tell with this film?
Well, the project was commissioned by Heather Layton, a senior art lecturer at the University of Rochester. And so she invited all people from all these 59 countries that gained independence from British rule to submit an art piece, and ours was in video form. And what we decided to do to celebrate the 59 Days of Independence project was to work with the children of the village of Galoya, which is this community where a project named called Wide Open Walls happens, and that's when we bring in international artists from all around the world to come and do some street art in these villages. And Galoya has been they've been the most supportive of the project, so it was just a no-brainer for us that, you know, should we shoot this project, that we have to focus around Galoya and these children.
And you keep it simple in the film, and you let the kids help tell the story with, you know, with simple props, little art, kites.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, we decided to give a kite-making workshop. And Galoya, firstly, it's not too far off the River Gambia, but pretty far away from the beach. And the landscape over there is a lot of rough, rugged trees and not a lot of places to fly kites. But not many of these children have the opportunity to actually go to the beach because of the distance from Galoya to the West Coast. And so we thought, firstly, we can give these kids a new experience, and secondly, teach them how to just make kites and hopefully pass on that knowledge to their children one day. But we had to work. We were limited by quite a lot of things. Firstly, obviously, no budget. And two, no materials whatsoever. So we had to get creative and find new inventive ways of making glue and making the frames for the kites. And it was a challenge, but it worked out in the end.
And if you wanted to know which are the nations that were free from British rule, the kids show you. And not only show you the names of the nations, but... the dates of, I guess, celebrating independence.
Yes. Well, there's this tree in the village called the Dead Tree, which everybody's really afraid of for some reason. But it was such a beautiful tree, and it was it seemed like the perfect art installation for us to add to the village. You know, other than just the paintings, and we wanted to drift away from street art because it's been repetitive. It's been artists coming in and leaving a painting and then putting up painting and then eventually leaving to never return. So we wanted to move off to sculptures and art installations, but wanted to make sure that there was an educational factor. So that is why we decided to make little leaves or paper leaves that were representative of each country. And on one side of the leaf, there would be the names of the country, and on the other side, their date of independence. And the kids would hang these leaves onto this tree, and it ended up being an installation that lasted a few months so that they could always go back to this tree and learn about these other countries and their dates of independence.
Well, certainly your viewers are learning. I was myself. I'm looking at this going, knew that, didn't know this, didn't know this one.
Yep.
Didn't know that. And that was very interesting for me just to even see that, not the least of which is the kids are beautiful children, and you know, so it was, I thought that was very clever. And you chose a little music as well, and it's music that some listeners will be familiar with, but tell us a little bit about the choice of music.
Well, we wanted to stay away from the cliche kora African kora. The kora is like the granddaddy of the harp, but we decided to use some banjo music because firstly it was a film that was intended for a Western audience. And if you trace back the history of the banjo, it kind of goes back to that part of the world. So we wanted to make it seem like music that contrasts with the imagery, but really isn't that far with instruments that kind of contrast with what you're able to see. But
let me just say, there is definitely a contrast, because when you're seeing the setting, the children, the theme, you would probably, if you're guessing what soundtrack we're going to put under these, you're going to think some sort of West African theme.
Yep.
And there is a contrast,
yep.
But it works. And it was sort of enjoyably paced and a nice, beautiful closing image. So I certainly learned as a viewer. And Josephine, what to you and the committee made you say, yes, this film needs to be in this festival?
Well, I think as the depth of it, as we hear here with the music, and how much was said in that short 7 minutes. And one interesting point, I'm not sure if everybody catches it, is that there's one kite that gets caught in that dead tree. And that is the kite from England, I believe,
that
right?
That is the Union Jack.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's an interesting point. And each one of these, there's just so much to it. It's not just the seven-minute film just shot. There's a lot of depth and levels on this. This is why we chose it for the festival.
Yep. So, and for viewers who don't really know the story, what do you want them to leave that, you know, the experiencing your film, what do you want them to leave with?
Well, I wanted to help make the film a little bit just more uplifting and kind of show people the beauty of the Gambia. And even in the Gambia, there's quite a lot of people who have never really been to that part of the country. Everybody's kind of clustered towards the West Coast in what they call the Kombo area. And so one, shooting it helped me fall in love with the Gambia all over again. Mm-hmm. It was actually a funny story. That was supposed to be my last day before flying out. I just had flown back in for a friend's wedding. And somebody suggested that to Lawrence and Jogu, Lawrence Williams and Jogu Touré, the other filmmakers involved in the project, that I was in the country and, you know, my film equipment was with me so that I could just help and volunteer. And I showed up on the very last day, and within those 15 minutes of being there, I knew that I couldn't fly out, so I picked up the phone and tried to see how I could postpone my flight.
And how much longer were you there?
5 days.
5 days.
5 days. And it only took 3 days to shoot, and then I had to take the project with me, take the footage with me, and then edit back in Beirut while doing some other jobs. But it was a really enjoyable process, and I never would have thought that this much would have come out of it. I mean, bring me all the way to Rochester and it being accepted. You know, and when Heather suggested, Heather Layton, the one who commissioned the film, mm-hmm. when she suggested submitting it to the Rochester Film Festival, we thought, like, yeah, why not? We'll give it a shot, but nobody really thought anything would happen. And then we'd keep getting emails that it was good news after good news after good news until it really got to the stage. And then we found ourselves, you know, getting on a flight and coming over to Rochester for this. So it's a lot of good came out of something really spontaneous.
Sure, it must be very gratifying.
Very, very.
The film is 59 Days of Independence. Can be seen when, Josephine?
On Saturday night.
That's on Saturday night at the Dryden. Yep. And so one of the 27 films for the 2016 Rochester International Film Festival, which again opens tonight at the Dryden at 8 o'clock for free, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and Saturday 4 and 8 o'clock. At the Dryden. It goes back to 1959, Josephine. Didn't really become international until 1964. But the goal in 1959, when this came together, what's the story? How did this come together to begin with?
Well, obviously, I was not there. I wasn't in Rochester. And
well, you know the story.
From what I'm told is that some engineers, Kodak, said, well, why don't we try, you know, making some films? And it was just their little group. And they actually used the Super 8 film, which is why our parent company is called Movies on a Shoestring, because of the width of the Super 8. And then it went on, and as you say, became international, and it just grew and grew and grew. And we are considered a very, very special short film festival, because we are exclusively short. We do not, you know, do anything else in the meanwhile. And the filmmakers love coming here. I'm always looking for homes to have them stay over and prepare all the, you know, program for them. They will enjoy our Niagara Falls. And we find this a very, very special treat to be able to be on this Connections program with you.
Well, you had a difficult work of paring it down, narrowing it down. Do you have an overarching goal of kind of a mix of themes and films? Because we in this room alone, you have three very different films, very different goals and themes, etc. Is there a goal of diversity of any kind, or do you choose the films that work best for you for a particular year?
Well, I mentioned the two-layer judging system. So when the second group comes, we have half a dozen judges, and we look at it in a marathon viewing, namely Friday night, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday. We looked at probably about 80 films, and we are voting on those. And then it comes to the line. This is where the line is, at the, you know, to fill in those four shows. And there is a bit of a little discussion sometimes about saying, wait a minute, that my film, that has to get in. So, but we end up coming out with a very, very diverse, you know, each year it's different and each night it's different. So my recommendation, the best way to see the Rochester International Film Festival is to come all four nights. And there are people who do. So all four showings. So if you can make it, we'd love to have everybody there at the Dryden.
I saw a headline this morning that at first glance, you might think is not exactly related to a film festival like this. But here's why I think it is. It's about who goes to films at all. And every filmmaker, every person in this room wants a world in which we, you know, the audience is growing, that you have a diversity of viewers to come to support film festivals, documentary films, not just the mega blockbusters, et cetera. I think we all agree on that. And they need that. But let me just read a little bit from the story that came out today, the story of Adam Aaron, who is the head of AMC Entertainment. He's been the head of AMC Entertainment for less than 4 months. And his concern is that younger audiences aren't even really going to the movies at all anymore. And he wants to make a bid to attract younger audiences. And so they are considering taking away their ban on cell phone and texting use during film usage. And here is, so at first I'm thinking, come on. You know, you're going to let people, you're coming to a film, whether it's a 3-minute film or a 2.5-hour film, you can't give it your attention. You have to be texting. And imagine sitting next to someone who's doing that, which would probably drive me nuts. But here is what Adam Aaron, the head of AMC, said about that. He said, when you tell a 22-year-old to turn off the phone, don't ruin the movie, they hear, please cut off your left arm above the elbow. You can't tell a 22-year-old to turn off their cell phone. That is not how they live their life. And he's essentially saying, if that's a deal breaker for coming to the movies, we're willing to change that. Now, again, I know that's, we're talking big film, big theaters, main sort of mainstream Hollywood films, big budgets, regular feature-length films. But I'm curious to know what filmmakers think that says about viewing audiences in general. I mean, are you concerned about, I mean, you probably all want younger and younger audiences. Well, all audiences. You don't want to just have an older audience or this or that. I mean, Pete, what do you think?
Look, it's the mysterious youth. I think there's a lot of, like, and I'm 34, so I'm to a young person, I'm 80. But I think there's a lot of conjecture about what young people want and what they need. And there's not a lot of data, and there's not a lot of asking direct questions. And this is an issue kind of worldwide. There was actually an experiment done in Asia where they actually let people text and react to the movie, and that would actually come up on the screen. That's actually something that's been done as well, where they're kind of testing kind of real.
Josephine's jaw just hit the floor.
Yeah, so like kind of real-time reactions. I think the problem is there's a lot of different people with a lot of different, you know, AMC is traditionally is a TV network. So there's a lot of different people who are kind of leveraging an opinion, but not really a lot of data that's being worked out in terms of what young people, you know, what they actually, you know, what is a young person? Is it 22 or under? Is it 15 years old? And actually finding out what their viewing habits actually are beyond the whole idea of they love their cell phones. Now, if you look at the binging habits around House of Cards, Game of Thrones, a young person can sit there and binge on 10 hours of something.
That's a good point.
If it's good. If it's good. I think the problem is there's a lot of stuff that's being shoved down the pipeline that isn't necessarily very good, and we're sort of saying it's all the same thing. You know, something that's good, if a young person doesn't respond to it, if something that's not very good, if a young person doesn't respond to it, we say that's the same as something that's really good that we're delivering to them as well. And it's kind of, it has to become a more nuanced conversation.
What a good point, because, you know, I wanted to say in a nice way that the films represented at this table and festivals like this are the ones we probably should be seeing more of, and yet the pablum that we see, you know, that makes $150 million is what gets made. You know, it's another romantic comedy, and you won't believe how it ends. You know, but that's what gets made. And what I hear Pete saying is, well, everybody assumes, well, this is a new generation, and they don't have the stamina to sit through a movie without even jumping on a cell phone or texting someone. But if we're making better decisions about what gets made to begin with, maybe that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, you can't ask somebody to watch something that you wouldn't watch yourself, that you're commissioning just to fill a broadcast hour or a broadcast slot, and then sort of say, well, I don't understand why they're getting distracted halfway through. You know, it's like, well, it might not be very good, you know, and you know, there's a machine that kind of works and a machinery that works. I mean, there's an entire movie studio that exists that basically their job is to fill slots in the Netflix catalog. And that's where Sharknado gets made. And I think we're up to Sharknado 4.
At least, which is making fun of the genre.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm at least understanding of, I don't watch them, but I get it. I get it. But I think I also take Pete's larger point. Anybody who is 21, 22, 23 might spend a whole weekend watching Game of Thrones mm-hmm. or House of Cards. Maybe that's older. But whatever it is, yeah, they can binge watch and give it plenty of attention.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think, Joseph?
Well, I do think while they're binge watching, they are constantly on their phone at the same time. You know, at those moments that falls short in the film. But in a theater, I mean, that's tricky because in a way the audience that is going is used to a certain, you know, piece, and the brightest thing in a theater catches your attention, and that's the screen. But if it's right next to you, that can cause problems. It's an interesting dilemma. I wouldn't want to be in the theater's shoes making that call. I mean, maybe they put blinders up a little higher on the seat so you can't see, like, if somebody's texting below that blinder, you know, whatever. But yeah, I think it's going to cause some controversy. But if AMC's the only one that allows it, maybe they do get all the youth in the theater, and then everybody else veers to the ones that might have the classic no cell phone policy.
Well, and that makes me wonder then, how are we going to, you know, make sure that that generation, which always, I mean, millennials always feel denigrated, and I don't mean to denigrate. I mean, we're just sort of observing behavior, and we're observing how businesses observe their behavior. How are we going to make sure that not only they're going to movie theaters, but also that they want to see interesting, well-made films, documentary films, film festival films? You know, I mean, I wonder if someone like Ian Massery, I mean, when you make a film like 59 Days of Independence, you don't know if it's going to get seen. And we all want our work to be seen. Authors want their books to be read. You know, how are we going to create a world where these films have a chance to be seen?
Well, the only medium that I have at my disposal is the internet. So the best I can do is probably start a Vimeo or YouTube channel and just hope and pray, hope that, you know, people find interest in the film. And it just catches up, and you know, you hope for something to snowball. But to tell you the truth about 59 Days of Independence, people only see it over here. My family hasn't really seen it until last week, and yeah, so that should kind of give you an idea of where people's interests are, you know. So, and the only reason why people are watching it over here is because the people of Rochester have really been pushing this film forward and trying to push it to a greater audience, and without them, it wouldn't have gotten the exposure or recognition that the film is getting. But I have that struggle. I can't really get people to see my film simply because nobody cares that much about short films. Nobody cares about up and coming filmmakers. They just they're used to the big names and or something that goes on Netflix or something that has good reviews. You
know, which is a cycle, right? Because you're not part of that cycle, so you're outside it.
I'm outside that. Way on the outside.
Well, sure, yeah. And they keep feeding whoever's on the inside, but voices on the outside, much harder to get heard. And I think of the conversations we've had about the music industry. And, you know, in some sense, it's more egalitarian than ever. You can use GarageBand and create sound. You can get something on iTunes tomorrow, but it doesn't mean that it's easy to get it heard. And if there are millions doing that, it's even more difficult. So I guess that's just my way of saying, I mean, how much appreciation I have for the films that not only do get made, but also get chosen to end up at festivals like this. So Josephine, before we lose the hour here, any other films, any other things you want to, I know all 27 are like your children.
Yes.
Anything else you want to, how about tonight? What's coming up tonight that you'd want people to know about?
Well, actually, tonight we have a film by Matthew Spall, who it's about the Center for Youth. And
that's right here in Rochester.
Yes,
in case
and
you
he's
know.
Over yep. At the U of R. We have a really very, very interesting film from Canada, The Path of Gray Owl. So there's a great variety. There's 2, 4, 7 tonight. And guaranteed you'll we don't have people, you know, leaving. They stay, watch all the films. And at the end, by the way, we have a Q&A. So if you want to, some of you listeners out there want to come and ask questions of these people, feel free. They will be on the Q&A the night that their film is screening.
Well, Josephine, how long? So the screening starts at 8 o'clock, runs until roughly when?
We try and keep it less than 2 hours, because then we'd like to have the Q&A so sure. people can interact with them. So the whole thing, by 10:10, I'm saying, come on, let's go. We have to get on to our next location, mm-hmm. because we do go out for a little gathering afterwards.
Well, hopefully the visiting filmmakers especially are enjoying Rochester, and everybody wants to know, what are you doing in Rochester? But I know everyone's busy. They're working, but hopefully you enjoy yourself. Hopefully, Ian, it's a good time here. Pete, I would ask you, Joe, but you know Rochester. So,
yes.
Hopefully you're enjoying yourself.
It's not bad. The only thing is my bag, I got here, my bag went to New Orleans. So it became sentient and went on a holiday on its own behalf. So I'm hoping it comes back with beads and some chicken or something. I don't know.
Just missed the big parties down there. Good luck on your films. Congratulations on all the success that you all have had just being here, part of these festivals. And very interesting films indeed. Our thanks to Ian Masri. Great having you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
59 Days of Independence. Pete Ireland from Australia, director of CHIP. Congratulations on that.
Cheers.
And thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Joseph Bellavia. Long John is the film. Having fun with that. Thank you very much for telling the story here.
Thanks for having me.
And Josephine Perini, Movies on a Shoestring and the Rochester International Film Festival. Another great year. Thanks for taking the time to tell us all about it, Josephine.
Certainly thank you for taking time to have everybody know what to do in Rochester.
All right. Tonight, 8 o'clock, The Dryden. Short break. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren next.